How's that? Oh, it sounds good. Does it sound good? Okay. Laura, how's that sound to you back there? Good? Okay. I think we have some friends still coming in. So just for a moment before we get going, what if we just close our eyes and just let your self and your body, your heart and your mind arrive here? And if it's your first time here, just allowing yourself to orient to this beautiful space. And if you've been coming here for decades, just allow yourself to orient to this beautiful space. And just to, again, as there's movement in the room, just to check in with how you're feeling this morning in your body, how your heart is. Sometimes it can be quite a lot to take the time out of our normal pacing of our days to come and sit still. And sometimes our bodies think, oh, this is wonderful. And sometimes not so sure. So just being able to meet wherever you are with as much friendliness and acceptance, curiosity as possible, and to perhaps hold that sense of playfulness and gentleness with yourselves as we share this our time to hear this morning together. And again, perhaps just taking a few breaths here, allowing your body and the contact points of how your body is in the chair or on the floor, just allowing your attention to land there as a way of perhaps steadying the mind, but also just arriving on a deeper level here in this room, together in this space, in this beautiful land, in this beautiful Wednesday sunny summer morning. It's wonderful to be here. It's my first time teaching for subbing in for Sylvia and Donald, and thank you for the flowers and the beautiful arrangements and the warm welcome and being here. And what I'd like to do, and I know some of you have been here for ages, but if we could just go around and share our names and where you live, and if it's your first time here, also to let us know. So my name's Grace Fisher, and I live in San Anselmo, and it is not my first time here at Spirit Rock. Do we need a mic or are we good without it? Oh. Thank you. It's kind of fun to have the mic. Thank you.
Hello? Okay. Good morning. My name is Julie and I live in San Francisco and it is not my first time.
All right. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Heather. I live in Point Reyes Station, and it is not my first time here.
My name is Paula, San Francisco, and I love it when I can make it up here on a Wednesday morning.
Beautiful. Thank you, Paula.
Mark Blackburn, San Rafael, not my first time.
Came in late, I guess, just the name.
Your name.
Yeah, it's not my first time, and we live in Colorado, and we come here for a month in the summer,
and beautiful. We're
so happy to come here as often as we can during that month.
Wonderful. Welcome.
Oh, and my name is Karen.
Thank you, Karen.
My name is Anne. I'm from Fairfax. This isn't my first time.
Thank you, Anne.
My name is Lisa. I'm from San Anselmo, and it's not my first time.
My name is Carol. I'm from Sacramento, and I'm a newbie.
First time.
Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Hi, John from Sebastopol. Not my first time either.
All right. Thank you, John.
My name is Margie, and I've been coming to Spirit Rock for many years.
Thank you, Margie.
Oh, I'm from Petaluma.
From where? Petaluma. All right. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Joan from Alameda. Not my first time.
All right. Thank you, Joan.
Hello, I'm Bonnie. I'm from Petaluma, and this is not my first time.
All right. Thank you.
I'm Keith, and I'm from Mill Valley, and this is not my first time.
All right. Thank you, Keith.
I'm Debbie, and I'm from Santa Rosa, and this is not my first time.
Hi, I'm Ted. I'm from Santa Rosa, and this is my first time here at Spirit Rock.
Hi, I'm Anna, and it's not my first time.
I'm Sean from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. First time here.
I'm from Pittsburgh.
relocating here now.
You what? You live out here. All right, great.
Trying to.
Go Steelers.
Hi, I'm Maureen. I'm from Marin, Sausalito, Mill Valley.
All right, thank you. Great, thank you.
I'm Robin from Point Reyes Station. Not my first time.
Susan from San Anselmo, been here many times.
All right, thank you, Susan.
I am Caroline from Fairfax, and this is definitely not my first time.
I'm John, I live in San Rafael. I've been coming to this class for several years now.
All right, welcome back.
Elizabeth from Novato, ditto.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Karen Villanueva. I live in Belmont on the peninsula nearby San Mateo. Grateful to be here. I think I came here for the first time a year and a half ago.
All right. Thank Welcome you. Back.
Thanks. I'm Dan from San Rafael. It's not my first time.
Okay. Thank you, Dan.
Diane San Rafael, an old Spirit Rock hand.
Vicki, San Rafael, longtime Wednesday morning visitor. Thanks.
Excellent.
Good job, Ann.
Exactly. You're doing a great job. And for those of you who came in, you might have surmised that we're just doing names, where you live, and if it's your first time at Spirit Rock or not. And there were some people who came in. Maybe if you could raise your hand if you haven't had a chance to share your name with us.
I'm Ann from Pinole, and this is my first time.
Welcome.
I'm Ernesto. This is my first time here also. I'm from Concord.
Beautiful. Thank you for coming today.
Ken.
Not yet. In right here.
I'm Brita from Fairfax and Big Sur, and I've been here before.
He doesn't want to speak.
So thank you for everyone for coming, and there's definitely some folks who traveled a substantial distance, so blessings to you, and let's have some fun today. Many of you know this is typically Sylvia's class and Donald Rothsberg, and so it might be a little bit different today from what you're used to, so hopefully we'll just bear with the changes that there might be, but try to follow what I learned from the schedule when I was here 2 weeks ago. So if at any point I am working on this, being mindful, but if I get going sometimes I can drop my voice and talk fast. So if at any point you're aware that I have dropped my voice and I'm then talking fast, if you just put your hand in the air, I'll understand what that means, because I'd so much rather you tell me that while it's happening than after class to come up and say, that was great, and I didn't hear anything you said. So just if we could work together on that, that would be wonderful. So how about we start with a sit? And we'll maybe sit for about a half an hour, and then I'll talk for a while, and then a chance for us to talk together. So if you just close your eyes again or rest your eyes and allow yourself to come into a posture that allows you to feel upright and alert as we take our seats this morning as sons and daughters of the Buddha. To sit in the Sangha that has deep roots over decades. Sitting on this land which has such deep roots, upon which apparently 10 million hours of practice have happened. And to imagine letting yourself slip into the stream of practice that has happened not just on this land, but we can touch into the stream of practice that's been happening for 2,600 years of people coming together to sit or to stand or to lie down quietly and notice what's going on inside. How is the mind state? If the mind is busy and agitated or spacey or jumping everywhere, can we sit with whatever comes? And again, that invitation to meet that which comes, the discomfort, the restlessness, the boredom, the questioning, the busy mind, the broken heart, the sore hip. Can we meet whatever we sit with a sense of compassion, friendliness? And for our anchor this morning, the place that I would invite us to rest our attention would be on the breath. Just to stay with that simple, though not necessarily easy, invitation of letting our attention stay on the movements of the breath. Whether we notice this in the movement of the air in our nostril, the inhalation or exhalation, breathing through our mouth, with an awareness of the temperature, or the subtleties of the breath, or in the rising and falling of our chest, or in the expansion of the belly. And the invitation is to pick one. And just to see what happens if I allow my attention to rest on the sensations and the movements that may be subtle or gross, of this life-giving force that is our breath. And our mind will do what our mind is good at, which is generating thoughts and opinions and stories and lists and rehearsing conversations, rehashing conversations. And okay, that's what the mind does. And the invitation is to undertake the training as we are doing to say, actually, we're going to rest our attention on the breath. And that might work for a few breaths, and then the mind pulls us out, and we come back. And sometimes the thoughts or the planning mind can be so seductive, we get lost for a while. And then we just bring our thoughts back. Oh, right. How is it to rest my attention upon the sensations of the breathing? If the mind is really busy racing about, sometimes it's helpful to give it a job of just counting or naming, noting in-breath, out-breath, One, two, three, four, without getting too caught up in higher numbers, and just keeping it simple. Allowing yourself to really accept and be with the idea there are no bad sits. We come and we take our seat, and as John Travis, beloved teacher here, says, we watch the theater of our mind. And as we are training the mind to stay steady on our breathing in one of those locations, it might work for a little bit, and then we'll get caught in something, and we come back. And that this is the dance of meditation. In these last few minutes of the sit, to follow in Sylvia's tradition, if anyone would like to speak into this circle of silence and welcome, anything that is lifting you up that you'd like to share, or anything you're struggling with that you would like to share. And this could also be if someone in your life is struggling in some way or celebrating something, to bring their name into the room and let us all hold that. So I just want to open, just come sit down, open the space up. We don't need to use the mic, but just to speak in to the circle if you'd like to share whatever you may be carrying, be it joyful or troubling. Good morning again. On a logistical note, to whoever the battery angel might have been, I'm aware I'm down to one bar. And if anybody knows where the extra batteries are in this room, thank you so much, Lyle, or Anne, thank you. Then we'll really have trouble hearing me. I know some people arrived since we did introductions, and for those of you who came in and missed saying your names, if you could just share your name and if this is your first time here at Spirit Rock or not. If you'd like. And you can just say your name.
I'm Karen. And it's not my first time.
Okay, beautiful. Thank you, Karen, and welcome.
And I'm
excellent. Oh, it's totally fine. No, thank you for coming today. I think there are some people in the back if you wanted to share your name. Hi, Danielle. No. Okay, great. So today in our time together, what I'd like to explore together are these notions of mercy and faith. And before I start going, I wanted to share a song. I was so moved by the beautiful singing that happened 2 weeks ago that I thought I might stay on that trajectory and start with a song. And some of you will know it by Leonard Cohen. It's called The Anthem. And I wanted to play it in the beginning as a way of sort of setting a tone for what we'll be able to talk about together. So we'll see how the self-brought technology will work. And bear with me if there's some challenges. I just think that's such a beautiful song in this invitation to really put down the perfect offering and really allow the cracks to shine, for that's where the light gets in. And it's certainly an oft-quoted line. But I wanted to play the song in part because I think it's beautiful, but also to kind of set this tone of how in this time that we're living, where there's so many challenges and so many levels, whether we're looking at the paper or in our internal world or in our family life, of how do we navigate some really hard, scary times? And to set down the idea that we can do this right, that we can somehow manage to get through this life without our hearts breaking or messing up or having people that we love hurt us terribly. And how do we keep our hearts open in the face of really challenging times? So I wanted to play with this today and just love that invitation of it's where the light gets in, of to be able to lean into the vulnerability, the places where we do get hurt, to say, no, there's strength there, and I can learn and I can grow. And it's just the myriad in this world of practice, there's sort of no greater opportunity to practice than when things are hard. And that's certainly what brought me to the practice of whatever I was doing wasn't working, and please let there be another way. And that has been true, I don't know, 20 years later, of just the wanting to be able to move in the world from a place of open-heartedness and tenderness, even when things are just so hard. And this idea of mercy. I grew up Catholic, and it has its own connotations from a Catholic point of view. But years ago, I heard Noah Levine talking about mercy, and it was this beautiful way of, like, can we be merciful to ourselves? And this extension of, in his book, and I can see the cover and I'm forgetting which of his books it is, but there's a chapter on mercy and his invitation that mercy is sort of the step before compassion. That it's all very well to talk about being compassionate, and the Dalai Lama talks about being compassionate to the Chinese, and how much he was able to grow in the experience of working with the Chinese. And with in Noah's book, of sometimes some of us, we can't offer compassion to someone who's hurting us, or we can't offer compassion to ourselves because we're not there yet. So his invitation is, well, try mercy. And his sense that in mercy is, from Noah, a verb. Mercy is a verb to stop hurting, to cease causing harm, and to end suffering. So this idea of mercy as non-harming. We might not be able to stretch to compassion just yet, but that the Buddhist path is a path of mercy, a path of sending suffering through acts of compassion and wisdom. Be merciful with ourselves, with each other, and the world, like the step before compassion. It's a willingness to abstain from harmful actions, not out of love or compassion, but out of self-preservation. Can we tolerate the unavoidable pain? Because not tolerating them causes suffering. And when we can learn to meet our pain with tolerance, we end the emotional suffering of hating. And I love that invitation of, can we meet our own suffering? Because when we don't and we put our suffering over here, it just comes out sideways to those people close to us or in some form or another. But if we can say, okay, come, let me hold this suffering, as Thich Nhat Hanh teaches, of like to hold your anger like a baby, or to hold your tender broken heart, then it's included and the light is shown upon what's happening, as opposed to this energy of, I don't want to look at this, and that's not me, that's not who I think I am. To be like, no, actually, the whole catastrophe of living lives within me in each breath, and can I make choices to respond in my better moments with a sense of compassion or mercy? And when I don't, and I screw up, and those things come out of my mouth, I'm like, I wish I hadn't have said that. Could I then meet my own experience, how I was acting in a way that's unskillful, with that same mercy and compassion of like, oof, yeah, sweetheart, you got caught. And to make amends from that place, to be able to open up to moving towards an apology when it's ready. But I can't do that until I've really been able to tolerate the pain of, what? Or someone said what? And just being open to that, the oft-quoted Rumi poem of, can we welcome and entertain all the visitors that have been sent from beyond for their, I'm almost said it, the welcome, sort of tenderizing us to being able to move in the world fully, that we don't leave parts of ourselves out. In this new book, which I'd actually thought about talking about mercy today before I got the book, but Annie Lamont's new book, Hallelujah Anyway, Rediscovering Mercy, she talks about mercy in this way. Mercy is radical kindness. Mercy means offering or being offered aid in desperate straits. Mercy is not deserved. It involves absolving the unabsolvable, forging the unforgettable. I think that's a typo. I think it's forgiving the unforgivable. Mercy brings us the miracle of apology, given and accepted, to unashamed humility when we have erred or forgotten. Mercy, forgiveness, grace, and compassion are synonyms and approaches we might consider taking when facing with a great big mess, especially the great big mess of ourselves, out of arrogance, greed, poverty, disease, and prejudice. Hallelujah anyway. In spite of all that, there is love. She goes on, mercy means we soften ever so slightly so that we don't condemn others for being. Father Ed Dowling said, sometimes heaven is just a new pair of glasses. When we put them on, we see this awful person, sometimes even ourselves, a little bit more gently, and we are blessed in return. Mercy is a cloak that will wrap around you and protect you. It can block terror, the dark and the most terrifying aspects of your true self. It is soft and has lots of folds, and it enfolds you. It can help you rest and breathe again for a time being, which is all we ever have. And I love that idea of wrapping ourselves up in this cloak of mercy and of tenderness and to slip in. I appreciate her naming also the compassion and grace and faith, because I think faith is in this too, to be able to hold, okay, there's more going on than the drama that I'm playing with in my own body or the drama that's going on the political or national stage or global. Yes, that's true, and there's more. In thinking back to Noah's idea of mercy as non-harming, or being able to pause, ooh, can I not respond violently or with harm? I want to share a story that was in The New Yorker, and some of you may know this, came out in 2005 regarding the Iraq War. It goes like this. During the early weeks of the Iraq War, the television set in my office was tuned all day to CNN with the sound muted. On the morning of April 3rd, as the Army and the Marines were closing in on Baghdad, I happened to look up at what happened to be a disaster in the making. A small unit of American soldiers was walking along a street in Najif when hundreds of Iraqis poured out of the building on either side. Fists waving, throats taut, they pressed in on the Americans, who glanced at one another in terror. I reached for the remote and turned up the sound. The Iraqis were shrieking, frantic with rage. From the way the lens was lurching, the cameramen seemed as frightened as the soldiers. This is it, I thought. A shot will come from somewhere. The Americans will open fire, and the world will witness the Mylai massacre of the Iraqi war. At that moment, an American officer stepped through the crowd, holding his rifle high over his head with a barrel pointed to the ground. Against the backdrop of the seething crowd, it was a striking gesture, almost biblical. Take a knee, the officer said. Impassive behind surfer sunglasses, the soldiers looked at him as if he was crazy. And then one after another, swaying in their bulky body armor and gear, they knelt before the boiling crowd and pointed their guns to the ground. The Iraqis fell silent. Their anger subsided. The officer ordered his men to withdraw. It took 2 months to track down Lieutenant Colonel Chris Hughes, who by then had been rotated home. He called from his father's house in Red Oak, Iowa, en route to study at the War College in Pennsylvania. I wanted to know who had taught him to tame a crowd by pointing his rifle muzzle down and having his men kneel. Were those gestures particular to Iraq, to Islam? My questions barely made sense to Hughes. In the unassuming, persistent Iowa tone, he assured me nobody had prepared him for an angry crowd in an Arab country, much less the tribal complexities of Najif. Army officers learn in a way, in general way, to use a helicopter rotor wash to drive a crowd away, or they fire warning shots. Hughes had been trying that day. I'm sorry. The problem is the next thing you have to do is shoot them in the chest. Hughes had been trying that day to get in touch with the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, a delicate task that the Army considered politically crucial. American gunfire would have made that impossible, and the Iraqis already felt that the Americans were disrespecting their mosque. The obvious solution to Hughes was a gesture of respect. And to me, this really pulls in this place of maybe not mercy, but that pause to be able to say what's actually needed, separate from what I could only imagine his own triggers, his own reactions would be in the face of this boiling crowd of Iraqis, of what could happen, that he had a sense of steadiness and presence to be able to think, what's the appropriate response? What's the wise response? As Sylvia said, the wise response is always compassion. And here he uses respect, which fits in the same rubric of how do we want to move in the world, and can we be allow ourselves the pausing to take a breath, to see what's actually needed. And in our day-to-day exchanges, when those people that can just kind of get me where you want to, where we can get triggered to be able to not respond. When we sit and we undertake the training to focus on our breath or on our bodies or whatever our practice might be and develop cultivating a sense of mindfulness, it's this practice to be able to put it into action when we're with another to say, okay, I can feel my energy rising in my heart doing this, and can I just stay with that before I say something I'm going to regret? And in that form, to me, it feels like this beautiful extension of mercy to myself of, it's okay, sweetie, you're caught. And that then prevents me from harming someone else through my own reactivity and words. I'll read a little bit from Annie Lamont's book because the sweet image that we'll come back to. She said, "There's the ancient Chinese had a practice of embellishing the cracked parts of valued possessions with gold leaf, which says, we dishonor it if we pretend it hadn't gotten broken. It says we value this enough to repair it. So it's not denial or cover-up. It's the opposite. An adornment of the break with gold leaf, which draws the cracks into greater prominence. The gold leaf becomes part of its beauty. Somehow the aesthetic of its having been cracked, but still being here, brought back not to baseline, but restored, brings increase." He says, mercy means compassion, empathy, a heart for someone's troubles. It's not something you do. It's something in you, accessed, revealed, or cultivated through use like a muscle. We find it in the most unlikely places, never where we first look. But this idea of the gold leaf, of really being able to accentuate and draw attention to the parts of us here in this, of really looking like, oh, I've really been wounded here. And can I embrace that and see how there's strength and beauty in it? For I know for myself, when someone allows me to see their own vulnerability or their own woundedness, it's so much easier to connect with that person and say, well, me too. Being human is hard. The John O'Donohue's line of, it's hard to be here. It's strange to be here. The mystery never leaves us. And being able to see each other, perhaps with that new pair of glasses, in our own challenges, and say, is it hard for you? Yes, it's hard for me too. That can be a settling down without trying to hold on to that perfect offering of, no, I'm going to look this certain way and present myself in the world a certain way. And yes, sometimes that's what's called for. And there are certain situations where we step into the roles. And with our beloveds and with how do we really want to choose, how do I show up in my deepest authenticity when I'm strong or scared or whatever? What am I really allowing myself to know about my experience? And what am I willing to share? And can we hold on or consider the idea of offering this mercy is actually this beautiful act of generosity, of caretaking of another. to that point in this book that I love, Just Mercy by Brian Stevenson. He's a beautiful lawyer who's been working with getting wrongly accused men off death row for decades. And of the piece I want to read, in 2010, the Supreme Court had announced the decision that life imprisonment without parole, those sentences that were imposed on kids convicted of non-homicidal crimes, was cruel and unusual punishment and constitutionally impermissible, which meant that a number of men who'd been sitting in prison awaiting the death penalty would be released. So this is the day that Mr. Carter was going to be released. Exhausted, so this is the attorney, it's his voice. Exhausted, I wandered the halls of the courtyard while we waited for one more piece of paper to be faxed and approved to clear the way for the release of Mr. Kasten and Mr. Carter. An older black woman sat on the marble steps of this massive courtyard hallway. She looked tired and wore what my sister and I used to call a church meeting hat. She had smooth, dark skin, and I recognized her as someone who had been in the courtroom when Mr. Carter was resentenced. In fact, I thought I'd seen her each time I'd come to the courthouse in New Orleans. I assumed that she was related or connected to one of the clients, although I didn't remember the other family members ever mentioning her. I must have been staring at her because she was looking at me, and she waved at me, gesturing me to come over. When I walked over, she said, "I'm tired, and I'm not going to get up, so you have to lean over here for me to give you a hug." And I smiled back, "Well, yes, ma'am, I love hugs. Thank you. Sit down, I want to talk to you. Are you related to anybody?" "No. No, I'm not related to nobody here, not that I know of, anyway." She had a kind smile. "I just come here to help people. This place is full of pain, so people need plenty of help around here." "Well, that's really kind of you." "Well, no. It's what I'm supposed to do, so I do it." She looked away before locking eyes with me again. My 16-year-old grandson was murdered 15 years ago, and I loved that boy more than life itself. I wasn't expecting that response, and I was instantly sobered, and the woman grabbed my hand. I grieved, and I grieved, and I grieved, and I asked the Lord why he let someone take my child like that. He was killed by some other boys. I came to this courtroom for the first time for their trials, and I sat there, and I cried every day for nearly 2 weeks. None of it made any sense. Those boys were found guilty for killing my grandson, and the judge sent them away to prison forever. I thought it would make me feel better, but it actually made me feel worse. She continued, I sat in the courtroom after they were sentenced, and I just cried and cried. And a lady came over to me and gave me a hug and let me lean on her. And she asked me if the boys who got sentenced were my children, and I told her no. I told her the boy they killed was my child. I think she sat with me for almost 2 hours. Well, for over an hour, we didn't neither one of us say a word. It felt good to finally have someone to lean on at that trial. And I've never forgotten that woman. I don't know who she was, but she made a difference. "I'm so sorry about your grandson," was all I could think of to say. "Well, you never fully recover, but you carry on." I didn't know what to do with myself after those trials, so about a year later, I started coming down here. I don't really know why. I guess I just felt like maybe I could be someone, you know, that somebody hurting could lean on. She goes on to say, "I guess to this point where some of the ones grieving the most were the ones whose children or parents were on trial. So I just started letting anybody lean on me who needed it. All these young children being sent to prison forever, all this grief and violence. Those judges throwing people away like they're not even human. People shooting each other, hurting each other like they don't care. I don't know. It's a lot of pain. I decided I was supposed to be here to catch some of the stones people cast at each other." I chuckled when she said it. During the McMillan's hearing, a local minister had held a regional church meeting about the case and had asked me to come speak. There are a few people in the African-American community whose support of Walter was muted, not because they thought he was guilty, but because he had had an extramarital affair and wasn't active in the church. At the meeting, I spoke mostly about Walter's case, but I also reminded people that when the woman accused of adultery was brought to Jesus, he told the accusers who wanted to stone her to death, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone." The women's accusers retreated, and Jesus forgave her and urged her to sin no more. But today, Our self-righteousness, our fear and anger have caused even the Christians to hurl stones at people who fall down, even when we know we should forgive or show compassion. I told the congregation we simply couldn't watch that happen. I told them we had to be stone catchers. I chuckled at the other woman's, older woman's invocation of the parable, and she left. I heard you in the courtroom today. I've seen you here a few times. I know you're a stone catcher, too. It goes on, but just that idea of being a stone catcher for ourselves and for others, can we see and be open to what's happening in the world to be able to say, lean on me? This doesn't, of course, literally mean going to the courthouse to do that, but just where are there places in our lives where we can open up a little to show mercy to those in pain to say, come, I'll hold you for a little bit, in whatever way that might be. Literal, metaphorical, some sort of softening, that idea of that mercy is a softening to allow this cape of compassion and mercy to hold us such that we can move in the world and be available to each other. To embody the Buddhist qualities of the Brahma Viharas, the four qualities, the four divine abodes of loving kindness, the friendliness to ourselves, to others, compassion to allow our hearts to quiver in the face of someone else's pain, to the joy, the sympathetic joy of the delight of when someone else's happiness, can we too share in that happiness and the crown jewel of equanimity to balance that, to be able to thread all of those qualities into our cloak of mercy, to be able to move in such a way that we lead with that lion-hearted quality of openness and care. I'm going to read one more piece, and then I'll stop. Oh, this is Noah's book, The Heart of the Revolution. So this book, I love this book, and those of you who have sat with me before know I talk about it at any opportunity. It's The Joy of Love, the Dalai Lama's and Desmond Tutu's book. And it was for the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday, and Desmond Tutu flew to Dharamsala, and they had a week together. And this book is the result of that week of talking about joy. And I just want to share this one part. As they're in conversation, the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Let me ask you, the Archbishop jumped in. You've been in exile 50 what years? 56. 56 years from a country you love more than anything. Why are you not morose? Morose? The Dalai Lama asked, not understanding the word. As Jinpa, the translator, hurried to translate morose into Tibetan, the Archbishop clarified, sad. The Dalai Lama took the Archbishop's hand in his, as if comforting him while reviewing these painful events. The Dalai Lama's storied discovery as the reincarnation of the Dalai Lama meant that at the age of 2, he was swept away from his rural home in Amdo, the province of eastern Tibet. It goes on. The odds of successfully escaping to India, as he did when he was a little bit older, and the Dalai Lama, were frighteningly small. But to avoid a confrontation and a bloodbath, the Dalai Lama left in the night, dressed as a palace guard. He'd taken off his recognizable glasses, and blurred vision must have heightened his sense of fear and uncertainty as the escape party snuck by garrisons of the People's Liberation Party. One of my practices comes from an ancient Indian teacher, the Dalai Lama began, answering the Archbishop's question. He taught that when you experience some tragic situation, think about it. If there's no way to overcome the tragedy, then there is no use worrying of too much. I practice that. The Dalai Lama was referring to the 8th century Buddhist master Shantideva, who wrote, if something can be done about the situation, what need is there for dejection? If nothing can be done about it, what use is there in being dejected? It's that idea of... The Archbishop cackled, perhaps because it seemed too incredible that someone could stop worrying just because it was pointless. Yes, but I think people know it with their head. He touched both fingers to the scalpel. You know, it doesn't help worrying, but they still worry. So when we look, and he goes on, when you look at the same event from a wider perspective, we will reduce the worrying in our own suffering. So to take that view, that sort of 30,000 foot view, as he talks about, well, other people have been exiled. Other people face pains of death of loved ones and divorce and losing our homes and losing our jobs. And can we remember that in our humanity we are connected through our suffering as well as our joys, and that the true pain comes from the loneliness and isolation, which in this book about joy, both the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu talk about that real pain of isolation and the isolation that can come from a sense of other, and that I'm alone in my own world with that which I'm suffering with, which then brings us to faith. In Sharon Salzberg's beautiful book on faith, she kind of outlines the sort of the bright faith, the first time perhaps many of us came to these teachings or a book that you're reading, you're like, oh, yes, that's great. That sort of bright, energizing connection. And as we, in this practice, the verifying faith is the testing, like, does this work? Is what's said, does that resonate with me? Does it make sense? Not the doubt of cynical doubt, and this is stupid, I'm going to walk out of here. Not that kind of doubt. But the questioning doubt. Is this relevant to my life? Does it work? What works? And Jack says all the time, like, take what makes sense, and if it doesn't make sense, let it go. Try it on. And the third piece of faith is the abiding faith. You've tested it out, and you know, like, oh, this is actually true, and you can rest in it. That abiding faith. I'm going to read one more thing, and then I'll switch gears a little bit. But this, too, is one of my favorite poems. It's called, well, I'm not sure what it's called, and I'm not sure who it's by. I think it's by Anonymous. So, one night I dreamed a dream. As I was walking along the beach with my Lord across the dark sky, flashed scenes from my life. For each scene, I noticed two sets of footprints in the sand, one belonging to me, and one to my Lord. After the last scene of my life flashed before me, I looked back at the footprints in the sand. I noticed that at many times along the path of my life, especially at the very lowest and saddest times, there was only one set of footprints. This really troubled me. So I asked the Lord about it. Lord, you said once I decided to follow you, you'd walk with me all the way. But I noticed that during the saddest and most troublesome times of my life, there were only one set of footprints. I don't understand why, when I needed you the most, you would leave me. And he whispered, my precious child, I love you and will never leave you, never, ever. During your trials and testings, when you saw only one set of footprints, it was then that I carried you. It was then that I carried you. And part of this piece of mercy and faith is actually allowing that something greater than ourselves, greater than this fathom-long body, can carry me and guide me through challenging times and those joyful times, but to allow in this sense that, oh, it's bigger than me and my drama and personalities. We're here together in Sangha, and Sangha is one of those triple jewels of the Dharma, to be together, to allow us to kind of ride in this boat together of whatever our humanity bring, whatever we experience in our humanity, can we lean into the idea? There's more. I can be, what is the Ojibwa quote of, I can be carried, all the time I go around complaining when I'm being carried through the great sky by the Spirit. And can we lean into whatever that might mean? It doesn't mean you have to believe in God or believe in anything, really, but the idea of leaning into the practice, which is an interconnective, interrelational practice, and that the connectivity of one person to another and remembering our shared humanity is what allows us to really live fully and be able to take care of each other. Okay, I could go on, but I'll stop. So how about if you close your eyes? And by all means, feel free to shift in whatever way to allow your body to come into a position that feels relaxed and supported and upright. I want to invite each of us to consider a time in our life that was challenging. It does not need to be the most challenging time, but a time where some part of us might have felt broken. A school adventure that didn't work, a job that didn't work, getting fired from our job, losing our healthcare, losing our house, losing a marriage, something, losing a dream. Again, selecting something that feels like it would perhaps be helpful to work with, but not tip us over into the more challenging emotions. But if you think of a time in your life where maybe you had the experience of, if not feeling broken, maybe a little cracked. Maybe just really in that place of, oof, this is hard, a hard place. And again, in as much as feels comfortable taking care of yourself, to lean in a little bit to what did that feel like in your body? Oh, this time is so hard. Can you imagine, again, in whatever image you might have, if an image does come to mind of this time of feeling broken in some way, if it's your heart that's broken or the will or whatever, to imagine that Annie Lamont's invitation of the gold leaf from the Chinese proverb of, can we put gold around the edges of our, quote, brokenness, or where the crack is. And to imagine this delicate, tender applique of this gold leaf around this tender, broken, again in quotes, place. To start to see this place of heartbreak or loss of some kind as a place of beauty. The crack, that's where the light comes in. We put down our perfect offering to say, ooh, how can I allow this challenge to lead me more deeply into my practice, into compassion, to serve as an opportunity to lead with my heart, to serve as an opportunity to grow, to connect, to put down the illusion of how I should be. And to play with, if there was an image that came of the sort of broken sense or just feeling it into your body, to allow that area to be suffused with light, stitched with gold, held, embraced by this cloak. This idea of, sweetheart, that's how, where the light comes in. Such as the sun's rays touch each of us, sun's rays touch so deeply these wounded places in us. And to allow, if you are willing, someone you know in your life, and it may be someone you're having a challenge with, it may be a dear one who's struggling with an illness of some kind, or if you have someone you've known in your life that has had that experience of, they have themselves felt, oh, something's not working, something's broken. Just as we could see with ourselves a sense of gold and light around our own pain, so too could we imagine the applique of the gold around our friends or our dear ones or a difficult person's wounding or challenges or brokenness, that for each of us, that wound is a profound strength place of strength and a potentiality for growth and opportunity. And what would it be like if we moved and lived in a world in which we saw each other's pain as golden light? We were able to expose our own pain, our own vulnerabilities, knowing that actually what I'm showing someone is my light, my own gold. And I see in the other their own gold, golden light, and the strength of their own vulnerabilities. We all put down the idea of the perfect offering, living in the way we should, looking a certain way, pretending to be. But really to be able to look around each day to the people we interact with, perhaps in this group, when you're out in the world, knowing each one of us has these cracks or wounds within ourselves, and to begin to train the eye to see in some way the golden light that shines from each of us through these places of growth. What's that world like? How would it be to move in that world? Thank you for your kind attention to listening to me. And I'd love to just, there's time to just open up to hear your thoughts on mercy or compassion or the exercise or whatever came up to you or your own sense. And I'd also really love to hear what your sense of how you, what mercy, how that lands in you. If it's like, oh, that sounds great. Or just to be able to have some conversation with each other about your experience or relationship to these words of mercy and faith. And if you could also say your name again when you speak, it would be great. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Susan. I really like the idea of mercy being kind of a precursor to compassion, because I find compassion really, really difficult when someone is criticizing me or hurting me in some way. And so the idea of mercy, when I think of the word mercy, I immediately see sort of like a Kuan Yin, a female, a woman, some kind of loving, maternal, that I don't know why, but mercy, that word conjures up maybe mare or mother or wherever it comes from. But and so I like the idea of it, and I was just thinking that maybe I could kind of, when I'm feeling upset with my partner or with somebody else because they've hurt me in some way, if I could kind of envision this being, this merciful being, as kind of helping me, because I really need help with it.
Beautiful. Susan, thank you so much. There is certainly more I can say, but I do want to, you've listened to me a lot. Oh, great, thank you.
I was, for the first time, and I want to thank you, because there was something that happened when I was very young. And you brought me for the first time to the feeling of have some mercy to myself and to see the humanity in it. So I want to thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It was very enriching, everything that you said. I was raised a Catholic too, and I struggled so much with it.
Yeah.
So mercy, it's not a word actually that something that I kind of associate with it so much, just because of so many things that happen within the Catholic mm-hmm. Church, and mercy hasn't been something that has been shown in many instances. So I have quite a bit of struggle. I'm still struggling. But I am so grateful that I found this Sangha, and that it's just filling me in so many ways and just enriching my life in so many ways. But thank you. It's the first time that I come and see you.
Yeah, that's true for everyone here. So thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Pope Francis has a book on the Church of Mercy, so it's interesting to hear his... share his view of mercy, because I had that. It's complicated.
Hi, I'm Caroline. Talking about mercy and compassion, I try to have mercy for myself when things pop out of my mouth that I wish I hadn't said, like what you were talking about. But I was trying to dig deep and trying to think, who are the people that I have a really, really hard time finding compassion for? And what I arrived at, especially in this day and age, was I really, really have to dig deep, and I haven't found it, and I'm maybe touched on it. I have a really hard time finding compassion for people who lie to get their way and do get their way by lying, whether it's, you know, our fearless leader, won't mention his name, or people in my life who have lied to me even in small ways, and I tend to be kind of trusting. Because I'm sure I've told lies, and I can probably think of instances, but not as a you know, matter of habit, just lying. So it confuses me, because I get very confused when I have to deal with people who are not telling the truth, and I don't know whether to believe them or not. So finding compassion for them is very, very hard for me. I'm trying to figure that out.
How does that idea of it... the mercy, the sort of the step before, does that help? Of like, okay, well, at least to...
Well, I try to picture in my mind maybe the mercy, or trying to think what happened to the people that tell lies in their life, mm-hmm. what caused them to either not even realize they're lying or just lie, like breathing, mm-hmm. And what happened to them in their life, and then I try to find compassion, like maybe that was the only way they could survive, or that was the only way they could feel good about themselves. I try to touch on that, to hit the compassion, and just instead of just reacting and being angry, right. You know, at those kind of people.
Beautiful. Pema Chodron, in her book, Places That Scare You, she... when the going gets rough... And she has four methods for holding our seat that provide just such the support for developing patience to stay open to what's happening instead of getting in that more reactive place. And her four methods are not setting up the target for the arrows, by which she means if we have not set up the target, it cannot be hit by an arrow. This is to say that each time we retaliate with aggressive words or actions, we're strengthening the habit of anger. And as long as we do this without doubt, plenty of arrows will come our way. We'll become increasingly irritated by the reacting of others. So if someone's lying, they get that spin of like getting angry at someone lying. However, each time we're provoked, we're given a chance to do something different. We can strengthen old habits by setting up the target, or we can weaken them by holding our seat and staying with ourselves. Remember that when we set up the target, we can always take it down, and we can hold on to our seat. The second instruction is for connecting with the heart. In times of anger, we can contact kindness and compassion that we already have. When someone who is insane starts to harm us, we can easily understand that she doesn't know what they're doing. But it's harder when someone is the same person, and how to respond, and how can we just hold on to our heart, our own heart in this. Connect with the heart. Remember that the one who harms us does not need to be provoked further, and neither do we. The third instruction is seeing obstacles as teachers. If there is no teacher around to give us direct personal guidance on how to stop causing harm, never fear. Life itself will provide opportunities for learning how to hold onto our seat. This teacher is always with us, always showing us precisely where we're at, encouraging us not to speak and act in the same old neurotic ways. And the fourth instruction, that it's helpful to think about the person who is angry, the anger itself, and the object of that anger being like a dream. We can regard our life as a movie in which we're temporarily the leading player. Rather than making it so important, we can reflect on the essencelessness of our current situation. We can slow down and ask ourselves, who is this monolithic me that's so offended? And who is this other person that can trigger me like this? What is this praise and blame that hooks me like a fish, catches me like a mouse in a trap? How is it these circumstances have the power to propel me like a ping pong ball from hope to fear, happiness to misery? And she goes on. But that idea of, in a way, just really trying to take whatever the challenges are, not quite so personally, and to hold on to ourselves, into our heart, and to make choices of what do we want to cultivate in ourselves. That step before compassion of, let me just stay here and not say anything. And notice the irritation that comes up when someone's lying, or the confusion and all of that. Like, okay, whatever this, wherever we get triggered, because as she says so beautifully, like, we're always going to have opportunities to work on things. To be able to think of these four steps. So, thanks. Please. The places that scare you.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't even see you. Hi, I'm Maureen. I know that some of this stuff goes back to my childhood. I was also raised Catholic. And when someone is judgmental with anxiety and has control issues, I kind of go into this fight or flight. I don't even want to be around. And I'm working on that issue personally with trying to be present. You talked about when people are vulnerable, that the vulnerability, and I did nursing for many years, can open up a lot with people, but sometimes people that are controlling, anxiety, judgmental are not going to open up to you. So how do you respond to that with mercy and compassion? And as someone else said, I will always be working on this, I feel. But I'm just, I had a situation about a week ago, and it's like, all of a sudden now I see why I'm so reactive with this person. And I try to be present more with compassion and kindness. And it's actually healing me.
Beautiful.
Instead of the fight or flight, it's given me an openness to see where I come. And as I've learned over the years, you know, people all come from their own truth. So I, you know, like in the media today, there's a lot about lying and blah, blah, blah. And the word histrionics is a word that was very impactful for me because you know, people don't even realize they're lying. They're coming from, a lot of times, their own personal judgment. So having mercy with that right now, or, you know, is a big thing.
Yeah. So thank you for sharing that. And I can hear Donald and Sylvia's voice in my head of sort of Donald being like, this practice doesn't mean you have to be all nicey nice and speak from that place, that that we can use our discernment to be like, I'm gonna walk away, or I'm gonna take care of myself in the face of when someone's really aggressive like that. That there are different forms of wise responses in terms of how do we take care of ourselves and stay safe. So I appreciate your naming that and that beautiful practice of, okay, how do I use this opportunity to really, what's happening in here? So thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, that nicey-nice thing. My question, the person who came up for me, and it was kind of nice because I didn't know where you were going with the visualization. The person who came up for me is a longtime work relationship, and so I've done mercy, and I'm quite compassionate, and I'm okay with her, and I'm okay also with how she regards me. I've been kind to myself. However, what about active mercy? Because as I sit with all of that, I'm aware that it's an organizational issue, so it's not just the two of us. And what about now, from that merciful, compassionate place, we still need to have a conversation that might be termed confrontive?
And to
how?
Right, and that the limitations of there's only so much you can do given the greater context of the institution or whatever it is, and just that awareness of there's limits to what's possible. And that can be disappointing. Really, the only thing we can really control is sort of our own reactions and heart place, which sounds like you've done beautifully. I didn't really have an answer to that question. Other than say yes, that's hard. Thank you, Britta. Thank you, La.
Hi, I'm Robin. The person that came up for me was my daughter, who's 25, and I came back from Boston less than a week ago. I went there to be with her during a surgery, and about which I have a lot of concern. And my career was as a nurse, and you know, I thought I would be in a caretaking role. That's why I went. And she was rejecting toward me, which is something that's never happened before. And so I've been so compromised by it that I almost didn't come this morning. And this has been right up my alley and exactly what I needed, so thank you, because thank what you. I experienced was my heart closing toward this person that I love more than anything, where I didn't want to talk to her and I didn't want to wear the pendant she gave me and stuff like that, which has just been starting to soften, and so I'm talking with her tonight, and this experience this morning has helped get me ready for that.
So, thank you so much. And may it go well tonight. And so painful. But thank you so much for sharing that.
Hi, my name is Paula, and I, like one of the speakers, have a terrible time with controlling aggressive people, especially when I find them controlling and aggressive toward others that I don't think can defend themselves. Mm-hmm. I feel like I can. Mm-hmm. And my big challenge is to not spring into action and try to annihilate them. I'm 5'1", so I can't really annihilate them, but I visualize myself because I really don't, I have no intrinsic understanding of people who have so much and who need even more and who must lie to get it. I have no intrinsic, and to be merciful toward those people I find tremendously difficult. I'm working on it. But my sister, the nurse, has taught me a lot because, like the nurses here, she's dealt with people at their most anguished. And what she said to me years ago that I try to repeat is, look, when somebody blindsides you, it's never your issue. It's not your issue. So learn not to take that personally. They're the ones that are in great pain or tumult or whatever it is. So take a breath before you jump in, you know, on behalf of justice or whatever you perceive justice to be. Take a breath, you know, and maybe by your taking a breath. And I've managed it not as often, you know, as was called for. But when it's happened, I do find over time, sometimes that person comes back, you know, in a way that's got more equanimity, so we can handle what we need to handle. Not all the time, but
yeah. Beautiful.
Mercy's really tricky.
It is tricky. And that choice of, okay, I can take a breath or have the intention to take a breath, or I can put more, sometimes can be more fuel in the fire, which just can make it worse.
Well, that's that target.
Exactly. So I love that instruction of don't set the place on fire, hold on to our heart, and then how is this a teaching? And in the moment, that's some deep practice. Very deep practice. Anybody else?
Hi, my name is Karen, and I'm so grateful to be here this morning. Thank you so much. My heart feels like it's softening from the week. Just 2 days ago, in the evening through early morning hours, I was crying for several hours, probably from one of my toughest experiences of seeing before my eyes a fear being manifested. Perhaps it came for me with an awareness. I wanted to work through a fear of judgment. And I was in conversation with a woman about my faith, my spirituality. And these days I'm in a place of not wanting to say I'm only one thing. I am all things, and I also have a Catholic background, and I've never had an experience in the past that has made my heart feel closed. And it didn't close this week, but it definitely felt broken from what I sense was judgment. And in this conversation, I shared with her my practices of what I do in my daily life, my work. And it's taken me some time. I'm in a chapter of my life where I'm practicing a lot of self-acceptance, coming into my truth of who I am. The work that I've been doing for the last 10 years is interior design, very much physically oriented of the material world. And going deeper within myself through the practice of meditation, I feel very connected to healing work, and that's the work that I do. I do Reiki.
Beautiful.
I channel, I pray for people, and I spoke to this woman, and she asked me, do you know how the Catholic and the Christian Church sees your work? And as soon as I, not her words, but the energy behind her words, I could already feel some judgment there.
Yeah.
And I've prayed so hard as I've grown up in my family of faith through prayer. And it wasn't ever about religion. It was about love. It was about compassion. But this woman looked at me with her eyes
it was piercing to my heart of this is wrong. You're doing something really wrong and you're on the wrong path. That's how I felt. She didn't say those words.
No, but to feel that sense of blame and judgment and how to be sitting with that ouch of it and trust, leaning back into what you know to be true.
Thank you, yeah.
And thank you so much for coming all the way from Belmont today to sit with us.
So I'm feeling a softening occurring just from sitting, bathing in the energy of the words and community, the stories, real life, coming more into self-acceptance. And I just want to share a few last words that...
And actually, would you mind if... Could I cut you off just because we are out of time?
Oh, okay.
But I love that you have your cloak on. I'm sorry that we are out of time, though. But thank you so much for sharing what you
thank
did
you.
Share. So thank you, and please come back. So on that note, because it's... and all the clocks here are different, say different times. So if you can just close your eyes, and I want to close with a poem from David White. It's called Faith. I want to write about faith. About the way the moon rises over cold snow night after night, faithful even as it fades from fullness, slowly becoming that last curving an impossible sliver of light before the final darkness. But I have no faith myself. I refuse it the smallest entry. Let this then, my small poem, like a new moon, slender and barely open, be the first prayer that opens me to faith. Thank you so much for welcoming me and having me be with you for the first time today. I very much appreciate it. And I think Sylvia's back next week, or is it Donald? So don't trust me, I don't know. Someone's coming back next week. But happy 4th of July. Thank you for all of you who came from great distances and near distances. And enjoy. Have a great week. And hope to see you again. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.